education professionals. Before I step into the exhibits, I just want to motivate it with just one brief comment. Can people hear me in the back of the room? Is this a fine volume? Number two, in terms of style, if you have questions during the course of this or if you have experiences and comments that you would like to give, I encourage you to do so. But also, in some sense, this is my show and I have to be over in 50 minutes. So I will exercise my prerogative as necessary. But I do encourage you, those of you that have worked in this area and given some thought to it, or qualifying questions, to interrupt at any given point in time. The motivation for this. This presentation has to do with a very narrow issue, and that issue is the cost of capital for financial institutions. It is part of a broader set of issues, and that broader set of issues really goes back to a question or a statement that was made by one CFO to me about a year ago. And the CFO made the following statement. He said, "Why does economic capital and risk management or economic profit matter? It doesn't matter for corporate strategy because given the price earnings multiple and earnings per share and earning per share growth rates, that's how corporate strategy is set within our financial institution." And so, on the back of this, all of the formulas, which are oftentimes called something like a RAROC, which is risk-adjusted returns divided by economic capital, if you will, which is oftentimes compared against a hurdle rate to determine whether or not a particular business is profitable or is contributing value, this internal metric, which is used by many financial institutions to set bonus policies, incentive comp pools, evaluate the performance of lending books, trading books, etc., there seems to be, at least from this one quote by the CFO, a tremendous disconnect between the way institutions are running their business internally versus the way they're setting strategy. Internally, RAROC, economic capital. Externally, well, just give me earnings per share growth estimates, and the PE multiple will tell us all we need to know about corporate strategy. This paper addresses a smaller part of a much broader issue, and that broader issue is how do we get internal metrics to align with external metrics in terms of share valuation and the types of targets that CEOs and CFOs are concerned about, i.e. share valuation. That's really the context of this, the motivation between this. And you'll see during the course of this presentation, is there any way to dim? Thank you very much. You're one step ahead. You'll see during the course of this, especially this first section on framing the issues, I'm going to try and motivate why this particular paper is a part of a broader research agenda that I would encourage the academics here to follow up on, because I think that there are a lot of interesting subjects, interesting questions that need to be addressed. Motivating the issue. Linking internal metrics and external metrics. This is an exhibit that shows the average total shareholder return inclusive under the assumption of reinvested dividends period of 1995 to 2002 for 50 of the largest U.S. banks over the period of 1995 to 2002. Bottom line represents the bottom performer. Top line represents the top performer. The gray dotted line that you can barely see is the 75th percentile. This dotted line here is the bottom 25th percentile. That's the median right there. Basically, what it says is that the bottom performing bank essentially didn't quite double their share price over that 7-year period. The top performing bank, on the other hand, within the sample, more than quintupled their share value. In other words, different management practices can lead to widely different management practices and strategies can lead to widely different results. In terms of linking internal metrics and the type of management processes and evaluating strategies to external value, there seems to be a challenge, and I'd like to motivate the challenge by decomposing value development into two components. And this is purely heuristically, but the two components that I'm going to put up are return on equity and the market-to-book multiple. Okay, and I'm just going to use that as a simple heuristic, and we'll see why in a second. But essentially, if you want to talk about the amount of time to double your share, you can think of it very simplistically as involving these two variables. if I am throwing off a return on equity of, say, 12%, and under the assumption of a 33% dividend rate, that tells you how much my equity is accumulating over time. My retained earnings are accumulating. The market, the books, tells me what kind of a lift I'm getting on that in terms of market valuation. Under a 12% ROE, a 33% dividend rate, and a market to book of one, it's going to take me, roughly speaking, about 10 years to double my share price. If, however, I have the same 12%, i.e., I'm throwing off the same amount of retained earnings into my capital base, but my market to book is 1.5, naturally, that valuation, the lift on that retained earnings is going to be higher. It's going to only take me 7 years to double my share price. And if I can boost my ROE up to 15% at a market to book of 1.5, it's going to take me less time, approximately 6 to 7 years, in order to double my share price. This is basically a simple decomposition of what is the driver, if you will. I'm trying to select variables here that we can explain. In terms of linking internal metrics and external metrics being the basis for performance comp, et cetera, most institutions feel reasonably comfortable trying to explain return on equity from an economic perspective, right? And that's oftentimes some adjustment over here with regards to RAROC. You can make interpretations in terms of economic capital, in terms of economic mark-to-market value in the numerator, recognizing true economic returns as opposed to accounting returns, adjusting for goodwill, et cetera. Where I think most institutions break down in terms of linking internal metrics and external metrics is being able to explain what is the basis of these market-to-book multiples. And, oh, this is a fun chart. It's kind of a throwaway chart. This shows the time to double for various financial institutions based on 2001 published numbers. So this is not a forward-looking time to double or a market analyst-adjusted time to double. This is basically saying that Lloyd's TSB had a market-to-book at end of 2001, December 31st, 2001, of 4.0, an ROE during that year of 24%. Using that very simple formula that I showed you earlier, what would be the time to double under a 33% dividend rate? Every 2.7 years, they double their share value at a 24% ROE and a market-to-book of 4. Deutsche Bank at the time had a market-to-book of 1.2. That's actually much lower right now. And an ROE of 0.4. That's actually negative right now. And if they had sustained that, it would take them approximately 360 years to double their share price. This is a chart that goes over very well in Europe. It's kind of a fun throwaway, but it just shows the wide variation in terms of performance and that the link to doubling your share price. If the problem of linking internal metrics and external metrics is the market to book, what drives that? Well, clearly, shareholder expectations drive that to a great degree, but also the economics of the business. This is a steady-state residual income model, which makes a specific assumption about the way that earnings flow through, or the way adjustments to the balance sheet flow through the income statement and hit the balance sheet. Basically, it assumes that anything that's going to hit the balance sheet flows through the income statement. Under that relatively simplistic assumption, under steady state assumptions, the market to book multiple, and there's a large literature on this, can be written in the following form. You get one, but then your market to book is one if and only if you're not creating or destroying shareholder value. So if your return on capital is greater than your cost of capital, your economic profit is positive, then you get a lift above one. Otherwise, why would shareholders pay a higher multiple on your business unless you're creating value above and beyond your cost of capital? So your market to book is greater than one to the extent to which you're creating economic profit. How much? Well, it's the capitalized value of that, because you're in a steady state, you're throwing off a stream of economic profit, and shareholders have a claim to that stream. And if that value is growing, then you get the perpetuity value of that growing stream of economic profit. So it has an intuitive interpretation, and quite frankly, you can think about how to make this discrete in terms of a shorter term horizon, 1 year, 2 year, 3 year, 5 year, continuing steady state value, etc. The point that I'd like to make is that, roughly speaking, That formula, in its simplistic sense, doesn't do all that bad in terms of explaining the market-to-book value of financial institutions. These are 21 financial institutions, all insurance companies in Europe, 5 years' worth of data ending 2000, where we added an error term and added two parameters to this, and we estimated those parameters and come up with a predicted value versus the model value. And it's, the R-squared was about 75% for different samples, depending on whether you use forward-looking analyst expectations with regards to growth versus the historical average, or whether you use analyst expectations with regards to earnings versus a five-year rolling average historical ROE. You get perhaps a higher R-squared. That's the subject of a different investigation. But basically, it doesn't do all that bad in terms of explaining that market-to-book multiple. This would lead us to suggest that management needs to focus not only on economic capital and adjusted returns, but not only on a one-period basis, as this formula would imply, but they also need to focus on the growth that's underlying the different businesses, as well as the cost of capital for those businesses. And potentially in a more articulated model of the value of a company, one could think along the following lines, and this is driven partly by intuition and partly by theory, that the market-to-book value, you might consider it to be composed, back in the days when there was excess capital above and beyond operating capital invested in the businesses, you might consider it as being a multiple of one on excess capital. Then your operating capital, which is tied up in operations across a multitude of different business units, earning a market-to-book potentially above one, depending on each different business unit's ability to throw off economic profit and their growth rates, the relative growth rates. One could consider this type of a framework in terms of describing, it's just a valuation by parts of a financial institution. What's interesting about this type of a framework for thinking about value is that there are a couple of distinct differences here relative to the way some financial institutions evaluate their businesses internally. What are those differences? Difference number one, and this is a claim to be tested and the narrow focus of the article that I'm about ready to present, is that the cost of capital is differentiated by business line. Right? And that's the focus and the motivation of the paper that I'm going to present. That's one issue where potentially the internal metrics may differ from the way the market values in terms of evaluation by part. The other issue has to do with capital. So, for example, is it economic capital tied up, or alternatively, in the case of an acquisition or where you paid potentially a premium, an acquisition premium on businesses, is it the invested capital that shareholders expect to return on? So what is that capital number? Is it excess capital? Is there excess capital, like most institutions claim? Is it economic capital? Is it invested capital adjusted for goodwill that shareholders expect to return on? These are another set of issues that have to do with the valuation that I think are still reasonably open and subject to empirical as well as theoretical investigation. But these are some of the issues that arise in terms of linking internal metrics and external metrics. This article, which was distributed out front, focuses not on those other issues, but really the issue of the cost of capital. And I wanted to present this framework for thinking about it, both to motivate the narrow question of what is the cost of capital for financial institutions, but also to motivate a broader potential research agenda that you might think about investigating, and that is what drives the valuation of financial institutions and what are the implications in terms of the way we manage them, the metrics we choose, and how we actually get value to our shareholders. With that introduction, I'd like to move to motivate the intuition behind the issue of the cost of capital and next a theoretical model where the author of the theoretical model or one of the authors is sitting in the room with us today, then move on to the results, and then finally the management impact. The claim of the article is that many institutions implicitly subsidize higher-risk businesses with lower-risk businesses. And the reason why they do so, or the mechanism through which they do so, is essentially by choosing a common cost of capital for evaluating each of the different business units. And this common cost of capital is oftentimes motivated by one of two statements. The first statement is that, and this I've heard many times, by differentiating the risk capital tied up in the business, you've already fully adjusted for risk, and therefore charging a different cost of capital for higher risk businesses would be double penalty. Now, in terms of industry practice, most institutions allocate capital based on what they do is they set it's almost an arbitrary process. They say, set a target probability of default tied to my target rating. Based on that, let's capitalize the business unit such that they achieve that theoretical target rating. And therefore, they're allocating capital based on both the systematic and idiosyncratic risk of that business. Okay? And they would argue that, but since we've already given more risk capital to the various businesses, to differentiate the cost of capital would be a double jeopardy, would be punitive, and therefore, quote, we shouldn't do it. The other argument goes something along the following lines. Even if it was correct to differentiate the cost of capital, we don't want to do it. Why? Because it would be too difficult to empirically estimate, or the strategic impact would be low, or management buy-in would be low, if not terribly painful, especially for the investment banking activities, and therefore we just avoid the issue. These are some of the rationale. Now, it turns out that there is a large class of literature, some of which follows Modigliani-Miller, some of which doesn't, some of which introduces information asymmetry, some of which introduces cost convexities or dead weight costs in order to get the results. There's a large literature which suggests, actually, that differentiated cost of capital should be applied from a theoretical point. My motivation in this article is to demonstrate that the market empirically expects a differentiated cost of capital, that it's not too difficult to estimate, and that the strategic impact is quite high, and therefore it shouldn't be ignored. That's what I hope to achieve with this paper, and I hope at the end of it you will agree with me. The practice within the financial services industry of using, how prevalent is this issue? Well, this is the results of a survey that we did last year of about 50 institutions where we interviewed the chief financial officer and chief risk officer. To the question, do you use a common cost of capital for performance measurement, 25% of the respondents, north of 50 of them, said we use a common rate. A further 40 plus change percent said we differentiate, but very slightly. We're talking on the order of 1 to 2%. A quarter of them said high differentiation, and about 10% say no differentiation. In reality, based on my practices, I think the numbers are actually quite a bit closer to no differentiation rather than more. So if this is a problem, it's a problem for, roughly speaking, if we believe them, about 65%, if not more, of the population. So it's a prevalent problem, if it is a problem. Now, the article tries to define this. In order to make this tractable, we try to estimate or define a couple of different effects. The first effect that we'd like to evaluate, I'm trying to put intuition behind this. The first effect is all else being what we call a differentiated cost of capital effect. All else being equal, do shareholders expect different returns from different businesses even if they are capitalized to a common rating standard? So that goes to argument number one, which is typically done. Let's assume that they're capitalized to the same probability of default, the same rating standard. Do shareholders expect differentiated cost of capital for different businesses? That's question one. Question number two, all else being equal, especially business mix, idiosyncratic risk, et cetera, do shareholders expect a higher return from firms with a higher probability of default, or more appropriately, a higher leverage rate? This is what we'll call the leverage effect. The more leverage you have for the same business mix, the higher the probability of default, does the shareholders expect a higher return on capital from that? Let's call that a leverage effect. Third effect is what we'll call an idiosyncratic risk effect. All else being equal, do shareholders put a premium on firms which have lower idiosyncratic risk? And in a Modigliani-Miller world, this comes about not because of dead weight losses and the avoidance of dead weight losses. It comes about because for the same rating, they can achieve a higher leverage ratio if they have lower idiosyncratic risk. Why? Because debt and probability of default is tied to systematic and idiosyncratic risk. The lower your idiosyncratic risk is, the more leverage you can achieve. So is that an empirically verifiable or a significant impact? And the fourth one I'll explain when we get to it. These are the effects that I hope to be able to address and test whether or not they make sense empirically. Before we do so, a little bit of intuition. Why would a differentiated cost of capital matter? And I'm just trying to be intuitive here. The next three exhibits are just trying to present some intuition. You can buy the intuition or not. But I think it's reasonably compelling. Why would a differentiated cost of capital matter to shareholders? Well, potentially because at a corporate level, shareholders are trying to evaluate the cash flows in excess of debt servicing levels. And the value of these cash flows in excess of the overall corporate leverage effect depends on the riskiness of those cash flows. This is one way to think about it. Now, if you don't find that intuition compelling, let's consider a very traditional model, oftentimes used in corporate finance, for determining the weighted average cost of capital for corporates. This can be found in Brealey Myers, this can be found in Copeland Weston, this can be found in Copeland Kohler, et cetera, evaluation handbook. Basically, under the capital asset pricing model, under the assumption that the probability of default is low and therefore the beta of debt is low, under those assumptions and rearranging, you get that the levered beta of equity is equal to some leverage effect times the asset beta of the firm. And in a multi-firm environment, roughly speaking on a first-order basis, that decomposes into the leverage effect times the weighted average asset beta of the businesses. Now, this simplistic corporate finance approach seems to at least capture two of the elements of intuition, i.e., the leverage effect and the differentiated cost of capital effect. If you don't buy that intuition, let's try some casual armchair empiricism. Let's compare the beta and therefore also the cost of capital for two different, radically different lines of business, insurance versus investment banking, holding, roughly speaking, the rating and therefore the probability of default constant. Let's wave our eyes and say that rating has something to do with probability of default. Let's just suspend belief for a second. Let's consider two different industries, roughly speaking, companies in them with roughly speaking the same ratings, Aegon, CGNU, AXA, and Allstate in the insurance space, pretty much pure play players, Merrill Lynch, Morgan Stanley, Goldman Sachs, Lehman Brothers in the investment banking space, and ask, what is the average beta? Now, roughly speaking, capitalized to the same probability of default. The beta difference between these insurance companies and these, quote, investment banks capitalized to the same rating standards, suspend belief, the beta difference is 1.9. Now, at a 5.5% risk premium, let's say it's a 5%, you could argue 5.556, I don't care what it is, a 1.9 beta difference on that much, on a risk premium that's around 5, that's about 10-12% cost of capital difference. Seems pretty big. On the leverage effect, let's do some more armchair empiricism. Let's take some universal banks, and let's just suppose that these universal banks have a comparable business mix. Now, on average, over the sample period, 1992 to 2000, Deutsche Bank had a very high credit rating. Let's say on an average, a AA+. Its beta was 0.94. Dresdner, National Bank of Australia, Commonwealth Bank of Australia, 0.88. Roughly speaking, a AA. Bayerische Hypo Vereinsbank, SocGen, BBVA, Besch, Santander, Central Hispanoamerica, Fleet Boston, higher, B of A, Royal Bank of Scotland, JP Morgan, and BNP Paribas, higher still. There seems to be a relationship here. Now, again, we're suspending belief here, and we're saying that the ratings line up to probability of default and that the business mix are roughly comparable, but there seems to be a leverage effect going on here. This is the intuition that might drive some of the results. I wanted to present some casual armchair intuition as well as some theoretical intuition just so that the results wouldn't seem startling. Now let's go to the model and the empirical results. The model is essentially borrowed. What I did was I borrowed a model that was developed by Michel Cruhe, Stuart Turnbull, and Lee Wakeman, published in 1999 in the Journal of Risk Finance. And basically it starts with a Merton model, a multi-asset Merton model, where the asset value of the firm is assumed to have some distribution with some probability, and it's basically a composite of log normally distributed. The asset value of the firm is a composite of log normally distributed business assets, okay, where the returns are log normally distributed. And after a certain amount of approximation, you can line up through, I was going to call it a method of moments, but all you're doing is lining up the moments. You make an assumption that the overall asset distribution also is log normally distributed. Well, in a single period environment, you can consider debt and equity to be respectively a sold put on those assets and equity be a long call on those assets from the perspective of those asset holders. If F is the face value of the firm, the value of debt at when the firm is unwound depends on whether or not there's enough asset value in the company to cover debt. They are a senior in terms of the claims of the firm. And the higher the asset value of the firm, the higher the recovery under debt. Until the asset value is greater than the face value of debt, at which point debt is satisfied. Looks like a short put. Equity kicks in above that face value of debt. So if there's enough residual value left over in the firm to be able to cover debt, equity gets the participation above it. That is a simplistic way to be able to value the debt and equity, if you will, of the firm. The basis for this model was Merton, 1974. Michelle and Lee and Stewart put that in a multivariate context to evaluate RAROC from a theoretical perspective. The only thing I did here was I built on the good work there. I did a first-order Taylor series expansion around the expected return to shareholders for holding that call option. And I basically took a first order Taylor series expansion, rearranged terms, and I came up with the levered beta, a formula for an approximation for the levered beta of the firm, which essentially says that there's some term which depends on the probability of default times the weighted average unlevered beta of the assets of the firm. Another term, which depends on the probability of default, times the idiosyncratic risk. Now, this looks surprisingly a lot like the corporate finance approach, which was constructed earlier. Makes sense. They both obey the Modigliani-Miller theorem. There's no cost convexities. There's no dead weight loss terms that are floating around. There's nothing else that enters in here. You've got a term which depends on the probability of default, multiplying the weighted average unlevered betas, and then you've got this thing hanging off the end. Let's do some interpretation of these. It turns out that first term, K1P, starts out at 1 and is monotonically increasing in the probability of default. Well, if you think about that leverage effect formula and that corporate finance formula, it was equity, the value of equity plus debt over equity. At a probability of zero default, i.e. 100% equity finance, it's equal to 1, and it increases monotonically. So it's looking like it makes sense. The second term, K2, is negative. Okay, so what that means is the higher the idiosyncratic risk for any given income-generating systematic risk component, the lower the levered beta to shareholders. Why? Because the less leverage they can get, and therefore the lower the returns, so the levered returns to shareholders. No cost convexity is nothing else. It all has to do with leverage. This is the theory that's underlying it. This is the model that we'd like to estimate. The data that we used was sampled for these financial institutions over a, I think the earliest element was 1992. The latest element was 2001. The data sample was not complete because some of these firms formed through mergers and acquisitions. The data that we needed was the levered beta from the stock market, which we estimated from stock market returns using a rolling three-year window, and it was a multi-period beta in the sense of, well, anyway, it's, we use a method found in Ibbotson, the way they estimate their betas. We needed some estimate of the probability of default, and what we did was we tried to track those firms that had Standard & Poor's and Moody's ratings, and in order to get enough differentiation, instead of taking the one-year implied probability of default for Moody's and Standard & Poor's, because for AAA and single A and double A, it's very close together, and we wanted to give the data enough of a chance to sing and tell us what's going on, we chose to take a three-year cumulative probability of default associated with that rating class. That gave us more of a spread in our explanatory data variables in terms of probability of default. The other missing piece of this was essentially the asset weights in the different business lines. So what we did was we went through the reporting structure or the annual reports of each of these firms. We tried to make adjustments for mergers or acquisitions, which had a fundamental change in the shape of it. We started out by taking 95 data in 2000, and then based on a proprietary capital model where we, based on our experience working with many different firms, we took the revenue side or the income side and then tried to say how much capital or what are the relative capital weights that are needed to support that business. So that's how we got those omegas. Because those are not transparent. We don't want revenue share, we want capital share. And oftentimes those are not available. This was the database that we had to work with. It took a while to assemble, had to make sure that you took account of mergers and acquisitions and the changing relative weights over time. We started out with a simple, we're going to estimate a series of nested models, and I think that I have about 15 minutes left, right? Maximum. Okay. This is a series of nested models. The simplest model is a relatively straightforward approach, which basically says the beta of equity is equal to a weighting on the betas of the individual business lines plus an error term. If we do this, we get an 88% adjusted R squared, high F statistic. The beta for commercial banking is 1.21, retail banking 1.23. Etc. and so on. Interesting numbers here are that the beta for equity investment banking is 4.34, quite a bit higher than the beta for fixed income investment banking. But if you consider the performance of equity, where we lumped M&A, corporate finance, other corporate finance, and equity businesses under that rubric as opposed to fixed income, you consider the performance of equity, those equity lines in the course of the last 2 years, you kind of get a feeling for the how cyclical that business really is. This was a starting point, and I think in general these betas seem to make sense. They're all very statistically significant, and in fact statistically significantly different from one another. These are the t-stat ranges, or the one, I forget how you call them. Unfortunately, I didn't normalize these and give you the percent. Let's just say this: at a 0.09 relative to 94, that is significant at a 99.9999-something percent confidence interval. What we found, though, in the data was something unique, and that was that the residuals were tied to the country of origin, right? And in the U.S., in the U.K., you had higher residuals than below for this simple model. What it meant was that the betas were higher for the U.S. and the U.K. than they were for other countries after normalizing for business mix. And we tried a functional form, which I'll explain the intuition for in a second, and I'd love to hear some other intuition for this, or whether or not we're doing something reasonable or unreasonable here. We said that the beta of equity is equal to the weighted average beta of the different asset lines, but subject to a being scaled by 1 plus a dummy variable times a constant, where the dummy variable tells me whether it's a U.S. or U.K. firm or a European continental firm. Now, why might this be the case? Okay, intuitively, and this functional form was chosen. Well, I'll tell you what the implications are, and let me just give you a little bit of intuition, and you can tell me whether you buy it or not. I'm not too sure about this myself, but it is very statistically significant. Here's my intuition. You take a country like Switzerland, where UBS, Credit Suisse Group, Swiss Life, Swiss Reinsurance, Balois Insurance, these financial institutions make up a very large percent of the Swiss market index. Why? Because the equity markets are less well developed, right? So whereas in the U.S. and the U.K., you've got a lot of different funding opportunities. Many more different firms can tap into the equity markets in the U.S. and the U.K. The threshold for being capital markets capable is much lower. Okay. Now, just think to take this to its logical extension. Suppose that the only firm listed on an index was a financial institution. What would its beta be relative to the local market? Be one, right? This functional form, in some sense, pulls the betas or allows the betas to be pulled closer to one for European continental firms, if that constant term is negative, which it is. So all this is doing, and it's very strongly negative, statistically significant, all it's doing is allowing the data to say that on average the betas for European continental firms are closer to one in absolute value than they would be, they get blown up for U.S. and U.K. firms. And the way I try to explain it or to rationalize it is that you've got more developed capital markets in the U.S. and the U.K. And I don't know whether that's correct. I don't know whether other research would lead you to similar conclusions or not, but that's just what the data seems to say. We'll notice that when we do this, we do get a slight change, a variation in the betas, but it's not major, a difference of 1.5 to 1.54, 4.3 to 4.5, 1.05 to 1.09. Not very radical in terms of its implication, but it is statistically, it helps to explain the error term. The reason why we didn't use an international capital asset pricing model here by trying to create a world index to do this on, the exchange rate behavior over that period, it's just, you get garbage. There's so much noise involved in that that it was proving fruitless. So we started out trying it under an international capital asset pricing model, gave up on that one, and we said, let's do it, look at local betas, just to do this. Now, so in the future models that we explore, it has that term. Now, what we're going to do is add a leverage effect. And the leverage effect is going to be a functional form that starts out at 1, and as the probability of default increases, if K1 is a positive estimated parameter, that increases. It's a linearization of that functional, that K1 functional form. Lots of linearizations here, lots of moving parts, probabilities of default entering at least two different points in the full nested model. Got to keep the functional form reasonably simplistic. R squared, adjusted R squared increases, F stat is fine, very little deviation in European dummy. Leverage effect is highly significant. It has a positive sign like we would have expected, i.e. the higher the probability of default for any given business mix, the higher the levered beta. Makes sense. And the betas don't change that. Well, they do change post-leverage effect reasonably dramatically, but they're not unreasonable, to my estimation. The final model included the idiosyncratic risk, and this was a problem because I needed an explanatory variable, which is the idiosyncratic risk of the firm. Now, I tried a couple of different ways to do that. I tried modeling that jointly, i.e., supposing that the idiosyncratic risk by business line was somehow proportional to the systematic risk by business line, or supposing that the idiosyncratic risk by line was wasn't necessarily proportional to the beta of the line, but had its own, was unique relative to the industry, the underlying asset industry. Turned out that there were just too many dependent, there was too many relationships that that depended on beta and the probability of default. You had two elements, both of which depended on the probability of default and betas at the same time, and trying to get reasonable estimates and trying to get the data to extract out both an estimate for the structural functional form for idiosyncratic risk at the same time as this model, forget it. I tried lots of different things. I wasn't bright enough to do it. So what I did was I did a trick that I saw in a paper by Renee Stoltz, and that is to say, I want a surrogate for the idiosyncratic risk of the company. I've estimated the betas already of those companies. The R squared of those original beta estimates tell me something about the proportion of variance explained by the systematic risk in the original beta estimates. The residual is in some sense idiosyncratic relative to the CAPM model. So what I did was I rearranged it, and this is a representation of the normalized idiosyncratic risk for these different companies, and that's driven off of the original levered beta estimates. Putting that in, we've got relatively stable parameters, a statistically significant at about a 90 to 95% confidence interval diversification effect, very significant leverage effect, very significant European dummy, and basically everything's looking good here. These are the estimates, the final functional, or the final estimates would suggest that equity investment banking is at the high end with a 3.58 beta, fixed income investment banking at 1.62, life insurance very low. By the way, this number has increased dramatically given the reduction in the asset base or the capital protection for life insurance, but that's a different story. Asset management about 1.43, 1.46 for commercial and corporate banking, and 0.99 for retail banking. What do I conclude? From a statistical basis, it appears as if shareholders, normalizing for probability of default, expect a different return for different business units, normalizing for different probabilities of default. Why? Because 3.58, there's a lot of daylight between that and 0.84, especially relative to the T-stats that you see. Claim one, differentiated cost of capital effect seems to be at least statistically significant. Leverage effect. This is the parameter here, highly statistically significant. It appears as if holding the business mix constant, those firms with a higher probability of default and therefore a higher leverage get a higher expected return, levered return to shareholders. So the leverage effect appears to be statistically significant. Diversification or idiosyncratic risk effect is also statistically significant. Now, what does it mean in terms of management? Because if you remember, the claims were, A, it's not theoretically correct, it is. B, even if it was theoretically correct, it would be difficult to estimate, it's not all that difficult. C, even if it was easy to estimate, the impact would be small in terms of the estimates, it's clearly not the case. Right? The difference between a 3.58 beta and a 0.84 beta in terms of cost of capital, that's roughly speaking 2.5 at a 5% risk premium. That's a lot of daylight between those cost of capitals. The final question to answer is, does it matter in terms of strategy and in terms of the way we manage our business relative to shareholder expectations? That's the final question, and we're heading down the stretch. What's the impact? I'm going to put forth this in the phrase that the CFO originally talked to me about. He said, price earnings multiple, right? Give me a price earnings multiple, give me my earnings per share estimate and my growth rate on those, and I'll set strategy. Let's see whether it makes a difference. Let's see whether strategy might not be different under this potentially misguided set of metrics, which many corporate CEOs and CFOs tend to use. Simple formula for price earnings multiple, steady state, perpetuity formula says that the lift on a unit of earnings is equal to 1 over the discount rate if you're going to receive them in perpetuity, and subject to growth if it's a growing perpetuity. Okay? So we'll take the cost of capital, which we've estimated, which we have a mechanism for estimating for different business mixes. Growth, let's just set that at 5% and assume it's constant across all these different scenarios. And then let's ask whether or not we wouldn't get different strategic directions if we had used a differentiated cost of capital versus the normalized or common average cost of capital for a firm. And in order to do that, let's take a look at a fictitious universal bank. This fictitious bank, no bank in particular, has a 40% asset weighting in retail, 30% in commercial and corporate, 10% in asset management, 5% in investment equity investment banking, 15% in fixed income. Completely made up asset mix. But let's just see whether this universal bank, it looks to me it could be a Citigroup, could be a not necessarily Deutsche because it's got too much retail, could be a UBS, Swiss Bank Corp, it could be a Barclays, right? That's 100% of the assets. Its levered beta is, roughly speaking, for a U.S. AA firm, about 1.5. That's not that far off. If you compare that with, for example, pure regional bank with 60% retail and 40% commercial, levered beta of 1.26 for a U.S. bank, AA. Yeah, I can see that. Cost of capital, 11.8% on average. Again, the risk-free rate was 3.5%. The risk premium was 5.5%. Using the data that we just estimate, the betas that we just estimate at that leverage rate, that would be the number. But look what that number is hiding. That number, 12% average cost of capital, and granted the risk-free rate has moved and the risk premium has moved, you can argue about that, doesn't matter because that number is hiding a wide difference in terms of the cost of capital by line. 25% for equity investment banking to a low of 9.3% for retail banking. The average price earnings multiple using that formula seems pretty reasonable. This is not outside of the range. Count on a universal bank these days is probably what? 13 to 14 to 16, somewhere in that range. I don't think it's that unreasonable. Retail banking, price earnings multiple about 19, say 18 to 22 in this day, growth is low. I could see that. These are not numbers which don't have an intuitive feel. Price earnings multiple 15 here for this fictitious universal bank. Underlying that is a price earnings multiple of about 5 to 6 for equity investment banking. Someone comes to you with an investment bank and say, how much are you willing to pay for earnings for that investment bank, equity investment bank? It's going to be pretty low today. Retail banking, 25. Again, we're assuming a 5% growth rate. That's maybe higher than the current environment, but it's a relatively a different number than here. If you are evaluating firm performance based on a common cost of capital, you're making a mistake because the cost of capital and the implied PE ratios after normalizing for rating and capitalization to a common probability of default, these businesses are radically different in terms of their PE valuations. And I've given you a couple of other fictitious firms here just so that you can compare them. Does it have an impact or potential impact in terms of the way corporate strategy is set? You betcha it does. A big potential impact. An impact which is tending to get swept under the carpet by a general average treatment of cost of capital and average PE multiples. Not all earning streams are worth the same amount in shareholders' eyes. Many people recognize that, but perhaps not formally in terms of the way they measure performance internally. And this ostensibly drives behavior and drives the internal fight for capital and growth within a firm. The next exhibit, basically, we only got two more exhibits. This demonstrates the difference between the leverage effect where we take by line of business a AAA rating versus a single A rating and ask what's the difference in terms of beta and therefore cost of capital, but then also in terms of price earnings multiple. Leverage effect is important. You can see that in this data. You have the table in front of you. The idiosyncratic risk, while statistically significant, is not significant at all in the data. So relative to the estimation formula, it's statistically significant. In terms of its impact on PE multiples, even after shocking that idiosyncratic risk, 1.65, taking the average and then shocking it down, lowering that idiosyncratic risk to 1.65 standard deviations below the average, no impact on PE multiples, none whatsoever. Basically, it's a small event. A percentage difference. This is not an absolute difference. This is a percentage difference. Percentage difference on the order of 2.5%. Bottom line is, I think that there might still be some research out there in terms of the impact of idiosyncratic risk. I think that there are a lot of control variables, i.e., the more diversified you are, perhaps the lower the idiosyncratic risk, but perhaps you lose focus. There might be countervailing forces here. I think there is research that can be done on this particular element of the puzzle. I also believe, to wrap it all up and bring it back home, I believe that there's probably also a significant amount of research that can be done with regards to the valuation of financial institutions from linking internal and external metrics. And I think the elements of, if I could just reiterate, the elements that need to be considered are very clearly the capital and capital allocation and attribution, the cost of capital, the growth rate, and I think the adjustments or the type of economic adjustments to returns and capital that need to take place. That concludes my presentation, and if I have time, and I'll leave it up to Dan's discretion.
I think we can take a few questions.
Sure. No, I didn't. I didn't really believe the results from the survey anyway.
Have you seen one bank which differentiated?
Yes, but it's implicitly as opposed to explicitly. There was one bank that actually took, there were a couple banks that did this, but one to an extreme, that took a much more of an outside-in valuation perspective in terms of setting strategy and compensating their people. So they didn't even allocate economic capital, right? So they don't have an economic capital. This is a top in the world, probably a top 15 bank, didn't allocate economic capital in terms of corporate strategy, strategy setting, strategic planning processes, etc. And what they did was they took a very outside-in perspective, and so they understood the drivers of market-to-book PE, cost of capital, the role that growth played, etc. So yes, there was a bank that did differentiate implicitly, but they didn't use that same internal framework. Other institutions that I've met did differentiate. I'm trying to think of one in particular. I think the largest that I think I saw between retail and investment banking, I did see one institution that was 10% gap. Most of them were much lower. Most of them were kind of an afterthought on the order of, say, 1% or even zero. Most of them were, in fact, zero. Other questions?
Break. We'll come back around 15:20 and.